someplace there's got to be a place where people are free to discuss what they know and what they don't know and to find out what they can.
Radioactive Waves is presented by the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History. Together, we will explore all things atomic, nuclear, and radioactive, along with some interesting surprises from our museum's collections and connections.
Hello, and welcome to the podcast. My name is Anna Part, and I'm here today with my wonderful co-host,
David Gibson. Thank you, Anna. This is a neat podcast we have today, and it is a video interview that was done for Nuclear Science Week via Zoom, and it was with Danielle Redhouse, and she is a nuclear engineer at Sandia, and I'll let her kind of get into that. She's got a neat history as well as a very interesting career, and she talks a little bit about what it took to get into her career and who she is. The video that kind of correlates with this will be uploaded to YouTube. So if you'd like to watch our YouTube channel, it's just Nuclear Museum YouTube. But there are also videos that are mentioned in this interview. And I kind of made the choice to leave those videos in because they're pretty audio descriptive. You can hear what's happening in those videos and get the idea. But we will also put the links to those in the description. So if you would like to check out those videos, they will be in the description to this. If you'd like to see the videos that Danielle's talking about and that you're hearing during this, they're just some short clips, but I do feel that they're kind of descriptive. If you don't, you know, get around to watching them, you will be able to understand what's going on just by listening. Well, this is a wonderful interview, as I said, and thank you, Danielle, for having this. I'm going to go ahead and cut to that interview, and you guys enjoy.
So my name is Danielle Redhouse. I'm a nuclear engineer at Sandia National Laboratories. And I'm also a member of Navajo Nation. So just to flow with that, Yate, Danielle Kithichini Inishye, Simbaketni Nishle, Shihin Bashchin, Bilagana Dashache, Ado Batatne Dashinale. So I just did a traditional Navajo introduction for all of the future Navajo students that might see this, that'd be great. Just a little background about me. I grew up here in New Mexico. I grew up in Albuquerque, actually. I went to school at Cibola High School, and I frequently visited my grandparents on the Navajo reservation. That's Tohatchi, New Mexico, which is about an hour north of Gallup. So I spent a lot of summers there, and it was really a precursor to becoming an engineer. So some hobbies that I like to do, I play string bass. I also like to travel a lot. That's one of my big things that I do, but I travel a lot for work as well, so it does get tiring. And yeah, so I'm a nuclear engineer. I went to my undergrad at the University of New Mexico, and then I went to graduate school at Texas A&M University. Yeah, that's been mostly my background as of right now for school wise. And I get asked questions all the time of, was it hard? It was pretty difficult for me starting out undergraduate at UNM. I would say that I was not fully prepared for college coming out of schools here in Albuquerque, but I did actually, you know, pursued it, and it did take a lot of work, and it was definitely worth it. So, let's see. I work at Sandia in the area we would call Tech Area 5, and that houses a lot of various nuclear facilities that we do various radiation testing at. And so I work in the group that tends to do a lot of the experiments there called the Applied Nuclear Technologies. And so actually we'll go ahead and do a YouTube video on a little bit of the background of what this facility has there.
The Nuclear Facilities and Applied Technologies Division at Sandia National Laboratory's Technical Area 5 is the leader in advancing nuclear technologies through applied radiation science and unique nuclear environments.
Our expertise includes reactor technology, neutron and photon dosimetry, radiation transport techniques, radiation damage to electronics and materials, and radiation vulnerability for Sandia-produced components.
We have a high level of professionalism in our ability to conduct experiments, conduct them safely, conduct them with an appropriate level of rigor with respect to how we measure and gather data to provide back to the experimenter so they can be assured that our dosimetry measurements and our diagnostic capability are of very high fidelity and with any uncertainties appropriately quantified, so they know what they're getting. They know the information that they're getting.
We do a lot of different experimentation, either for universities or for private industry. What we essentially do is we work with the customer and we acquire one of their samples that they want irradiated. And I specifically work with them to see what particular reactor cavity at what time and what reactor power works best for their needs and what they're trying to achieve.
Our research environments include the Annular Core Research Reactor, or ACRR. This pool-type reactor has a large dry testing cavity that can operate in steady state, pulsed, or tailored transient mode, and allows for customization of radiation environments through the neutron-gamma ratio.
Our capabilities are unique. Our breadth of experience is very broad, and our abilities run very deep. We have capabilities that no other reactor facility in America, certainly and perhaps the world, have. Because of our unique skill sets amongst our staff, we can deal with almost any challenge associated with the hazards presented by an experiment.
Another research environment is the Gamma Irradiation Facility, or GIF, which provides high-fidelity simulation of nuclear radiation environments for materials and component testing with various test configurations and at different dose and dose rate levels.
The Gamma Irradiation Facility is where we use cobalt-60 sources. We irradiate all kinds of mostly electronic parts, but we've done a lot of other cool experiments as well, just to see how they survive a radiation environment. Well, cell 1 and 2 are the smaller cells. Cell 3 is large enough to put an M1 Abrams tank in. We can operate all the cells at any given time or all at the same time.
The Sandia Critical Experiments Facility is another unique facility designed to conduct experiments to improve the efficiency of the fuel cycle in the U.S. fleet of commercial nuclear reactors.
We're the only ones doing these sorts of experiments. There's a lot of people around the world that are interested in them. The experiments we're doing right now are focused on building the database to support operation of commercial nuclear reactors at a fuel enrichment higher than they can go to right now.
The Sandia Critical Experiments Facility also offers hands-on nuclear criticality classes, one for criticality safety professionals and one for managers of staff that actually handle fuel.
Another capability at Tech Area 5 is the development of state-of-the-art methods to characterize complex radiation environments in the nuclear facilities through dosimetry at the Radiation Metrology Laboratory.
What we do is we make the measurements for all the experiments that happen in our unique facilities here. So if somebody wants to do an experiment in the reactor, they need to know what kind of radiation environment they created within the center of the core. So my job is basically to tell them what happened during their experiment and to see whatever effect they were looking for.
Tech Area 5 customers have included Department of Energy, Department of Defense, NATO allies, NASA, DARPA, and Homeland Security.
Our workforce is passionate about advancing nuclear technology and is recognized worldwide for our ability to transform ideas into results through design, prototyping, and testing.
The management team here really fosters a learning environment, and that's demonstrated by them allowing me flexible hours to work on getting my PhD in my spare time. They sent me over to Oxford, England last summer to study at the World Nuclear University. So they're very supportive of young people developing and acquiring higher education and continuing to foster a learning environment here at TA5.
There's always something new to work on. There's always a new problem to uncover. there's always a new challenge facing us or facing the complex, which then they ask us to solve those problems. And if that's something that intrigues you or interests you, then there's no limit to the kinds of things and activities you can be involved in here at TechnoVerify.
Great. YouTube video for background on the facilities that I test at most regularly. And so where I fit into in that section would be, they talked about the radiation metrology lab. So in the simplest terms, my specialty in the field of nuclear engineering is to look at facilities for their applicability for any of the customers that we host. And so I try to develop reports that give a high fidelity or a very certain understanding of radiation fields for both neutrons and gamma ray environments. And so I investigate facilities. I present the data on if they're applicable for use to the radiation testing community, and they can choose whichever facilities that they need for any specific type of experiment that they need. But the primary facility I do test at is ACRR. And typically when I'm talking about testing here, it's the exact same that they spoke on here in the video. A lot of it is electronic testing, materials testing, anything that you would need to require a knowledge of radiation effects on it in an environment tends to be what is studied here. And that is a wide range of things from satellite communication systems have to survive radiation environments in the exo-atmosphere. You have to also work on medical. So we've done a lot of work with the Moly-99, which is used for chemotherapy and radiation treatments. It's a very large breadth of research for Sandia as far as radiation effects testing. So, but basically, and so the main facility that I do test at is ACRR, and actually, if you want to pull up that video, I can just give them a quick background here, but ACRR is a very unique reactor. It's one of a kind in the U.S. It's a very interesting reactor. So, and so this operates in very special, I guess, energy regime. So the video mentioned that we operate in steady state, and that's up to what you would what we call is 2 megawatts, and that's actually a significant amount of power. So that'd be 2 megawatt operations for a steady state for some given point, some given amount of time. And then our pulse operations can actually reach 250 megajoules, which would be over very few seconds. Yeah. So it is a very unique reactor. Those radiation fields are needed for a lot of components, a lot of electronics that need to survive in radiation. So if you want to go ahead and play that video, you can check out ACRR's 10,000th cycle, which should be a max pulse.
Good to go.
Yeah, and so that is the video, and I still love seeing ACRR pulse every time, even though I've worked there. So that tends to be the facility that I operate or work at the most. This reactor is actually very similar to several research reactors that are housed at universities. And so you tend to really want the max amount of radiation you could possibly have in a short amount of time, or just a total very high dose of radiation.
Is that what the pulse is? Is that like a whole lot of radiation at once, or?
A pulse, I guess you could call, would be just like a high power, and power is going to be directly proportional to your radiation fields. But it's more or less kind of just the unique environment of a high radiation environment happening within a few seconds. That tends to be kind of where that's either a desired environment you want to look at, especially if, you know, an electronic isn't really going to see radiation except for maybe a few times, and it's an intense radiation, like when they're making medical devices or medical, even medical sources. Sometimes a lot of the electronics components only see very intense amounts of radiation for a brief moment while they're being cycled through facilities. So that could be a case in point of where you'd need a pulse environment, whereas steady state would be for total survivable dose. And that would be for something that's like a communication satellite that would be in space getting a constant dose over its entire lifetime while it's, you know, going around the Earth until it's, you know, planned life cycle ends. So both of those are kind of the areas in which you'd be looking at those radiation environments for either a steady state or a pulse operation. So, yeah. And so I guess I could kind of go over like what's a day in the life of, you know, what I do. And so I will say that my days usually do start pretty early, especially if I'm doing experiments. You know, I usually get into the lab pretty early, probably like 7 a.m. You do what we call checkouts. Basically, if you're doing an active experiment, you make sure that your electronic component still works before you actually put it into any sort of reactor, any radiation environment. You want to make sure that before you do that, you made sure it worked beforehand, because that kind of defeats the purpose. You're like, well, I actually didn't know if it did work before. So, so we tend to do that. Like the video said, we have dosimetry that we put on each item to make sure that, you know, while it's in any sort of radiation environment, we can backtrack what the actual number value of that environment is. And like the amount of the type of radiation, the amount of radiation that it saw, that's very important for tracking and making sure that you meet the requirements that the customer has asked for. Very important aspect. And a lot of the time, all of the work that you go through at a nuclear facility, the number one part of that is safety. Yet you're near radiation. Radiation is a hazard. So everything that you approach when dealing with sort of working in that sort of environment is, you know, we want to make sure that we get the science right, that we want to get customers everything right. But we also want to make sure that above everything else, that we conduct experiments, we get the data that people want in a safe manner. So a lot of the times on first days, second days, it's really more of a slow movement to make sure that you're methodical, that everything's done correctly. And then obviously after items are rated, you tend to have to wait for a while to touch them, because with neutrons, especially, neutrons activate material and they physically change the material to most likely a radioactive isotope. And so you kind of want to let them decay before you handle them. And sometimes you can't handle them at all and you have to remotely move them somewhere else until you can actually get your hands on and manipulate and figure out, you know, if a part or material has it changed, kind of what types of data you're trying to get out of that.
Yeah.
So, and you know, for me, test days tend to be long. And I think most experimenters would know that when you have a test day, you try and really maximize how much you can get done in that day, because you have very little time to do experiments. At facilities like ACRR, Spur Critical Experiments, GIF, you know, they have a line of customers every week. And when you do get your week or even a day, you want to make sure you maximize that. So experiment days can be long and grueling, but they're definitely worth it.
But they're the rewarding day of the project.
Oh, yeah. You have all this planning before experiments too, like months in advance. You're gathering all the data, you gather all the parts, you make sure that they're behaving correctly. It's a whole process, but the day that the experiments happen, days after, that is like you're wrapping up a very big project, and it's very rewarding to finish experiments and to kind of see, you know, did I get what I told them I was going to get? And absolutely. And it's definitely the best part of my job is kind of getting that whole cycle of start to finish. It's great. I think if there's any questions at all, I think we're getting close to almost 30 minutes. Sure. So I was gonna go ahead and open up for.
Now, Marie had asked a question earlier in a chat in the
during the event here, and maybe that would apply, but that this would also apply to me. Do you guys do tours?
ACRR and a lot of TechRA 5, there are tours.
Okay.
They do tours sometimes. It's very limited right now, just because when there is a packed week schedule of testing, it's actually hard to fit in when they can walk you through a facility that's actively running.
Okay.
Yeah. So like, obviously, if they are doing any type of operation, they can't really house people through as a tour. And classically, if we do have tours, it's for people who are visiting, actually doing research, but there are always opportunities to tour it. And especially, I think, closest to Sandia's family days, which I think are every 4 years, you can definitely get on site and see almost everything you can at Sandia. And TechRA 5, parts of TechRA 5 would be included in that.
Sure. Another question, I kind of had a pile of them while you were going there. That's okay. When you said that, you know, your customers or people that are looking for to have something irradiated, how is there like a waiting list? I mean, or is that something like you guys actively search for people, or is it something like there are so many people that are looking for this kind of thing? Government, I'm sure, contracts, that kind of stuff. But I mean,
Our classic way of doing this, so myself and my specialty, I actually do have a waiting list of facilities that require like high fidelity characterization and understanding of their radiation environment. Mm-hmm. So I do have a list of customers, and there's actually a wait list. And so people have to jump on and, you know, notify me like, you know, this year, I would like you to actually start working on this. And I let them know if that's going to work. So there's definitely a wait list there for that. For something as like testing at ACRR, every year we put a call out for who needs time at the reactor. And I don't think in my almost 8 to 7 years at TechRA 5, has there ever been really a time where it's like, we don't have anything going on this week.
Yeah.
So every schedule.
A field that keeps you busy for sure.
Yeah, and so obviously there can be times where external to Sandia customers book time, and something happens, they don't get their experiment right, or someone dropped it or broke, and they can't make it in. So then there will be canceled weeks, and those canceled weeks always get filled in. It's that type of work. It's nonstop. There's never not experiments to do.
I guess that was my question. Yeah, are you just back to back, like? You finish one up and then you pile on the next one, or have multiple going at a time?
Oh yeah, they're piled up and they're waitlisting. There's mm-hmm. people waiting behind them, or there's people who didn't get on the year's schedule who, you know, you let them know we'll have a waitlist. There's usually cancellations. When there's cancellation, it's like, you're up, are you ready to go? And yeah, we definitely have a lot of customers.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So when in like, is this something that you, when you are working, I mean, I know you said like your experiment days are longer days, but I mean, is this normally something that is like a 9 to 5-ish? I know you said you start early, but I mean, is it, you know, you're looking at normally a 40-hour week unless you're testing, and then it's a 1,000-hour week.
I would say test days, test weeks, I do tend to do a lot of hours. Sometimes it verges on 50. And it all depends on just how much I need to pack into that test week. But yeah, definitely. And test weeks don't happen every week. That would be completely unsustainable for Sandia sure. to have us try and do. And especially like travel test weeks, definitely not every week. But yeah, my classic days of doing the planning for these test weeks are, you would call it a 9 to 5. And actually, I think I do more of like a 9 to 6, and then I get every other Friday off. So
sure.
the classic Sandia 980 schedule.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
That's the go-to.
And Marie, if you've got any questions, I've got just a couple more. But Marie, if you've got any, you can put them in the chat. We appreciate you showing up here. Another is, you say that like, you didn't call it on the road testing, but like where you're testing somewhere else, is it a matter of you take equipment and all of these wonderful things, and you have to set up in their environment and test their environment either for, like, say, a large amount or a long-term exposure. But I mean, is that like you have truckloads of stuff? Or I mean, is it a lot? I mean, how much equipment does it take to test a facility? And I'm sure it varies by this facility, but
yes,
you know, what is kind of the basics of that, I guess?
Good question. So I will give a shout out to the two universities that we've worked with testing at. And the main one right now I've been looking at is the University of Texas at Austin. They have a trigger reactor at their nuclear engineering teaching laboratory. And so we've done a few test campaigns out there, and it's a fairly new facility that we've tested at, and it's mostly because they just have a really high thermal neutron environment. So that'd be more slow neutrons. They cause more interactions. Okay. Definitely interesting from a materials perspective for a lot of people. So I would say we classically, for every on-the-road testing trip, we take multiple millions of dollars worth of equipment with us. And we ship it out early in these massive crates. We send three out of like just electronic diagnostic racks. We call them racks, but they are very similar to in size. Let me think. Oh, maybe very similar to almost the size of a fridge.
Really? Yeah.
So you have three of those, and they have as many, you know, high voltage power supply. God, I'm spacing right now. Power conditioners, power supplies, all of the above, anything you could possibly need, thermocouple systems, cooling systems. And on top of that, we send probably up to like 7 or 8 Pelican cases, which have all amounts of soldering equipment, cabling, tape. Surprisingly, a lot of things need taping on the road, and hand tools, any of the above. It really comes in handy where if you're doing something and it's not working out and you need to fix it, it's not like being at Sandia where I can be like, oh, go run to the lab, take this with you, fix it, and come back. There, it's really like, what do we have to fix this? And actually, that's a good segue to previously when I said, you know, kind of having fun at my grandparents' home in Tohatchee, New Mexico, on the reservation. I definitely, over the summers, you know, no toys out there, nothing. Right. But what they did have was like a lot of like just garbage laying around, which is kind of a sad thing. But as a kid, you're like, there's a lot of like stuff here I can like build things with, like
on
the
fly. That is not a sad thing. That's a beautiful thing. Yeah. I work with children now, you know, a lot at the museum. And that, you know, part of what I do is that, hey, let's just take things apart and let's build something. Let's make something.
Yeah.
And the garbage is a wonderful toy.
I know. I mean, you're like, you have like carts. You're like, let's take this cart apart. Mm-hmm. Let's make like this weird sled thing. Let's like ride it down a hill. It's probably not safe. But as a kid, you know, that's what we used to do. And then I find myself doing that now, like almost like MacGyver stuff. I'm like, let's get this thing working. Let's do this, and, you know, you have stages of also kind of trying to fix things or making them work. And especially when, you know, you test it leaving Sandia, it works. And then you get there and something's not working. You definitely go through a very rigorous staging of let's try this, you know, common issue first. And then you start stepping down all of the issue lines with it. And then the very last thing is, you know, this item has died somehow in transit. And then you've lost a part to test, and that's always disappointing for any customer I'm supporting to kind of call them and tell them like, hey, I have no reason as to why your part died, but it did die on transit and stuff happens.
Hmm. So your day to day is definitely not just analytics. It's also a lot of hands on let's make this work type stuff. Also, it's not computer days entirely. It's working with these physical objects in the physical world also.
Exactly. My job is actually really good at a nice mixture of, I do a lot of analytics. You know, all of the data that I collect for my own personal specialty, it takes weeks, several weeks to process all of that to get them the information they want. Planning, there's a lot of people planning and just logistics too, that people would never expect that goes into, especially like on the road testing, massive amounts of work for making sure that things arrive there on time, making things sure things leave on time, Yeah, it's definitely a lot more. It's a nice mixture. I still do get a lot of computer work, but I always, you know, any chance I get, I'm usually at the lab. Any chance I get to do experiments, tends to be what I really like to do. And I did start out in engineering as a programmer. So I programmed a lot for codes, fixed up a lot of older codes with neutron transport kind of theory. And I originally thought that I'd be really good at that. And I just remembered at one point doing it, and it just kind of felt like I wasn't a nuclear engineer anymore.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to one of the graduate teachers I had at Texas A&M, and they were like, well, I always thought you were a really good experimenter. And I was like, I think it's time to switch over. And I definitely feel like this is more of a groove for me. I definitely prefer a wide variety of activities to do as opposed to kind of computer stuff. I do like the computer stuff, but along with everything else.
Yeah, that is part of instead of the whole.
Mm-hmm. It is. That's definitely, I think for a lot of engineers, some people just thrive in that computer environment, and other engineers such as myself, I need every portion of engineering that includes hands-on, probably wrecking stuff too, like just all the above, accidentally powering on things the wrong way, just all of it. Like,
right.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That is awesome. Well, if that's good for you, I appreciate you coming in. That's all of my questions. I do enjoy hearing from you, hearing your story. Like I said, I was excited to speak to you after I had heard your story previously. So that's pretty awesome. If Marie, if you don't have any questions, we're probably going to go ahead and close this one out, if that's okay with you, Danielle. And I appreciate you. I really enjoyed this. So thank you for being part of Nuclear Science Week.
Yes, I'm more than happy to do Nuclear Science Week. And I should say, before we get off this meeting, that I became a nuclear engineer because when I was a little kid, I loved the Nuclear Science Museum. Back when it used to be over near Old Town, it was like my all-time favorite elementary, middle school, like, trips. And I think that stuck with me all the way through until I was like picking a degree. I was like, nuclear engineering sounds cool.
That's awesome. So, well, that's wonderful to hear. Yeah.
Come full circle now.
now you're part of us. Yeah. So that's wonderful. Yeah. And that's awesome.
Thank you for having me. This was an awesome opportunity, and I'm always happy to come back.
Well, thank you very much. Well, I sure appreciate you. I'll let you get on with the rest of your day. And thank you for joining us.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Have a wonderful afternoon.
Yep. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks again, Danielle. And thank you to Anna. And thank you, as always, to our Atomic History patron members. We really appreciate you for making this podcast possible. And as we say at the end of every podcast, don't forget to wash your hands. Radioactive Waves has been presented by the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History. Join us next time for more interviews, histories, and insights on topics like the Manhattan Project, science and pop culture, the atomic age, and the differences between nuclear fact and fiction.